I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The first round of regime change in the Middle East is over. Saddam Hussein is deposed. But it is still unclear whether a war fought in the name of spreading stability and democracy will actually do so. The next stop on the Middle East peace train is supposed to be the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And there is news today. A threatened showdown between Yasser Arafat and the new Palestinian prime minister has been resolved. Mahmoud Abbas, better known as Abu Mazen, has been trying for the past 2 months to form a new cabinet, one that would win an official blessing from Arafat and Palestinian reformers, and prompt the release of the still-secret and long-awaited roadmap for peace. Arab, European, and American officials have been pressing Arafat to reach an agreement so that Abu Mazen can finally be sworn in and get to work. And just an hour ago, that agreement came, prompted by some last-minute Egyptian mediation. Arafat has now approved Abu Mazen's cabinet. Connection listeners, how will a new Palestinian government change the picture in the Middle East? How aggressive should the U.S. be in pushing the peace process now that the war in Iraq is over? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And in just a moment, we're going to be going to Ramallah Live on the West Bank to hear from New York Times Middle East correspondent James Bennett. But first, we want to hear from our studio guest this hour. He is Khalil Shikaki. He is director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. He's in Boston at the moment as a guest in the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Welcome back to The Connection.
Thank you very much. Well, it's good to be here.
It's good to have you with us, and especially now we have breaking news happening. Are you surprised that they were able to resolve this impasse?
I am surprised. I think that it has been extremely difficult for Abu Mazen to find his way during the past 5 weeks. Arafat seemed to be extremely insistent on maintaining power and not sharing it with Abu Mazen. I think the decision today is a landmark decision, and hopefully, we still don't know all the details of what has been agreed upon, but it seems that Abu Mazen indeed will have his own government, and that essentially he did not need to make significant concessions to Arafat in order to do that.
I wanted to pursue that a bit because, as you say, the details are just now starting to come in. The distinction that seems to be drawn, let me make sure I get this correct, was that Abbas is now going to be interior minister and Dahlan is going to be in charge of security affairs, but he's not actually going to be a minister. Now, what difference does that really make?
The only difference is that Abu Mazen will be the one with the operational power as a Minister of Interior. But this is what Abu Mazen wanted to begin with. Arafat did not want Dahlan to have an operational capacity as head of the security services with a ministerial mandate. And Abu Mazen was fully aware of that in the past. And in fact, his title was not to be an interior minister. Dahlan's title was originally to be a minister of state for internal affairs.
Is this about titles or is this about power?
No, it's about power, certainly. Arafat knew that as a minister, Dahlan will indeed have full control over security services in charge of maintaining internal security. Now he will have a certain capacity, but the man in charge, the man who will be held accountable by Arafat, by Fatah Central Committee, by the Palestinian Legislative Council, is not Dahlan. It will be Abu Mazen himself. And Arafat believes that he will have a lot more control over Abu Mazen and the government if indeed Abu Mazen was the man who is responsible.
All right, we have James Bennett on the line now. He's the New York Times Middle East correspondent. James, a lot of news happening there. What's the latest?
Well, I'm actually standing in the compound in Ramallah right now. They've just finished meeting. Abu Mazen has left. Arafat has gone back inside. And, they're presenting this with some euphoria as an important agreement. They're calling for the Americans to quickly introduce the roadmap and get moving with the peace process here.
What finally seemed to get the job done?
Well, I mean, if you listen to Yasser Arafat's advisors, they're saying, well, it was always going to happen at the last minute. This is just the way we do things around here. The Egyptian intervention today was critical, I think, in making it happen. But I don't think we can discount the element of theater in all this. Bringing it down to the wire, handling the process the way he has enabled Yasser Arafat to send a pretty clear message, I think, as to who is still in charge.
Certainly nothing like a deadline to concentrate everyone's attention. But if we can break up some of the elements of the international pressure, Tony Blair's gotten involved, the Egyptians have gotten involved. Who do you see as being the key players who made a difference?
In terms of reaching this agreement finally?
Yes.
Well, there's I'd like to point out one group that hasn't really been heard from in this whole process, which is the Palestinian people. We haven't actually seen any demonstrations out in the street one way or another about any of this sort of thing. There's tremendous international pressure that ultimately was key to getting an agreement. And in a sense, that's a liability, I think, for the new prime minister, because it creates the impression that this was imposed from the outside. He did very little during this process to try to engage the intention of Palestinians, to rally them behind him, possibly because he was trying to avoid confronting Yasser Arafat directly that way. But in the end, it makes this seem like less of an organic process of democratization and more an externally driven creation to enable this roadmap to be declared.
James, what was at stake for Arafat here? I mean, was this impasse more about his legacy and his pride than perhaps his desire to move the peace process forward?
Well, I think as Dr. Shikaki, who knows more about this than anybody else, already said, is it was about power, really. In the end, that is what is at stake here. And there is, perhaps we're beginning to see the diminution of Arafat's preeminent control over Palestinian politics. So that really is at stake. There are obviously elements of status and prestige, respect that he feels that should be due, frustration with the way the Americans have cut him off. But ultimately, it is about control.
All right, James, we thank you so much for taking a few moments out of what I'm sure is a very hectic situation there to speak with us.
Thank you.
James Bennett is the Middle East correspondent for The New York Times. So let me pose that question to you, Khalil Shikaki. Why haven't we heard from the Palestinian people about this? Why haven't they been out in the streets saying, we want something to happen here?
To a large extent, the Palestinian public has been shielded from the debate, not only about the individuals, but about the policies of Abu Mazen. It's Abu Mazen's failure to a large extent. Indeed, he didn't want a confrontation with Arafat over this issue. He didn't want to go over Arafat's head, speak directly with the Palestinians, mobilize Palestinian public support for himself. This is the legacy of Abu Mazen. Abu Mazen is not a great communicator. He is not a man who speaks to the people. He likes to isolate himself. And it's for this reason that his own popularity rating is very low among Palestinians. So I believe to a large extent Abu Mazen is responsible for the fact that the Palestinian public has not been invited into the process to play a role in the process. The Palestinian Legislative Council has allowed Arafat, Abu Mazen, and the old guard members of the Farah Central Committee to deal with the issue among themselves. And therefore, the council simply played the wait-and-see game, hoping that once this issue is resolved, then it will come back to them, and they will make a decision. Obviously, the decision is theirs legally, but as a matter of fact, once Farah Central Committee decides on the issue, and I think the agreement between Abu Mazen and Arafat settles that, they have decided they will go to the council, and their vote means something. It means that a majority of the members of the parliament who belong to Farah will indeed support this cabinet. If there was a disagreement, Abu Mazen would have taken a risk going directly to the cabinet, to the Legislative Council, without the blessings of Arafat or the Farah Central Committee. And in that case, most likely, the parliament would not have given him a vote of confidence. But as of now, I doubt very much that the parliament would hesitate to give Abu Mazen a vote of confidence. What is striking is the fact that the Palestinian media in general has also avoided really serious discussion of the issue. And Palestinians have heard about the disagreements over the names as well as the policies from an international media, not the Palestinian media. And that's in part the legacy of authoritarianism in the Palestinian political culture. The fact that over the last 10 years, the Arafat has created a very authoritarian political system in which open discussion of these issues, including his own role and the fact that he's being marginalized as a result of this process, is something that the Palestinian media has not been willing to openly discuss and display to the Palestinian public. A major failure that I am hoping that the changes that now with the new government means Palestinians will be able to address.
You are a pollster, so you frequently go out and take the pulse of the Palestinian people. I want to ask you a question about that in a moment. But first, we're using a couple of names interchangeably, and I wonder if you can help clear that up. Sometimes we call him Mahmoud Abbas, and sometimes we call him Abu Mazen. Is one more correct than the other, and why does he have two names?
Well, Palestinians call themselves after the names of their elder sons. And Abu Mazen had a son who died about 6 months ago. His name is Mazen, so he's called Abu Mazen, the father of Mazen. His personal name is Mahmoud, and his family name is Abbas. So he is Mahmoud Abbas, who is the father of Mazen, Abu Mazen. Now, Abu Mazen is also a sort of a name de guerre for Mahmoud Abbas. That is the name he has used as a founding father of the Palestinian National Movement and Fatah as a guerrilla group. Same as Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat also has a name de guerre, that is Abu Ammar, as his name, which is used, which would be equivalent to Abu Mazen. Most Palestinian figures, in fact, do have these double names.
All right. You were speaking a moment ago about the difference in power between Abu Mazen and Yasser Arafat. And to me, those figures were striking when I read them in your poll, that Abbas has about 3% popular support and Arafat's is still around 35%. So when you see those numbers, you can understand a little more about how this whole thing has shaken out.
We have to distinguish between two things. First of all, the support for the man, Mahmoud Abbas, isn't there. He's not an electable leader, as I said. He is not a great communicator. He doesn't talk to the public.
Doesn't give interviews.
He hardly gives interviews. He hardly speaks and expresses his own opinion on the issues. So you really have to get things out of his mouth almost by force so that you would know what he thinks. But he's very good in one-to-one conversations. He's also very good and effective in expressing his views in front of a small group, but not in public. And it's for this reason that he has not been able to mobilize much support for himself. But having said this, I must also say that under an authoritarian leadership, it's very, very difficult for anybody to create a sort of an alternative leadership, to see anyone as being a natural successor to the leader, to the man who, the authoritarian figure. The Palestinian National Movement had one leader, and that was Yasser, and is Yasser Arafat. He's being weakened now, but he's still very much the symbol of the Palestinian national struggle, and is viewed as such. His leadership is being questioned by the majority of Palestinians, and that's why his rating is also not great, 35%. For a man who was elected by more than 70% of the public to go down to 35% is a great deal of loss of power in terms of public perception of his own leadership. But having said this, Abu Mazen, as a prime minister, is perceived a lot more positively by the Palestinian public. There you have more than 60% of the Palestinians who think that indeed he could be a good prime minister.
Navigating the roadmap to peace. We are discussing this hour the prospects for a democratic government in the Palestinian Authority and for a lasting peace with Israel. Connection listeners, with today's news that the threatened stalemate between Yasser Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas has been avoided, and with a new cabinet now in place, what should be the role of the United States? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about today's news that a new Palestinian cabinet has been named, despite expectations of a stalemate. Connection listeners, what does that mean for the United States in its pursuit of a roadmap to peace in the Middle East? You can join us by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me in the studio is Palestinian pollster Khalil Shikaki. And joining us from Washington is Ambassador Edward Walker, president of the Middle East Institute. He also served as the ambassador to Israel from 1997 to 1999. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador.
Well, good to be here.
Shall I call you Ambassador or Ned?
I think Ned is a better term.
Okay, it's a little easier. Let me ask you, first of all, whether you see this post-war period in particular as one of history's tipping points when change becomes more possible.
I think it's always true that when you go through a major structural change in a region like the Middle East, that it opens up opportunities as well as risks. And I think we're seeing some of the risks today in Iraq, but we may well be seeing an opportunity with regard to the Palestinian issue. Certainly, President Bush has made it clear to virtually every leader in the region that once the Palestinian Authority forms its government, that we will move forward on the roadmap with the publication of the roadmap and our efforts to encourage both sides to accept it.
Give us an outline, if you will, of what that roadmap is. It hasn't been published officially, but we certainly seem to know a lot about it for something that's supposed to be kind of under wraps.
Well, it has been leaked in many forms, and there are different versions of it. Actually, the Europeans had a version once before, and then there was an agreed version between the administration, the UN, the Europeans, and the Russians. That basically sets up a structure not altogether different from Oslo, but with some primary fundamental changes. The first period is a consolidation period in which the Palestinians undertake to provide security and to eliminate terrorism to their full potential, and in return, the Israelis undertake to pull back from the areas that they have occupied and to relieve the pressures on the Palestinian people so that their economy can once again grow. It's a series of steps that will improve the atmosphere. At the same time, the Israelis are called on, as the Palestinians get terrorism under control, the Israelis are called on to freeze the settlements so that they don't become a stumbling block for future negotiations by continued growth.
And in fact, we heard some move in that direction on the eve of Passover from Ariel Sharon.
I thought that was a very encouraging statement by Prime Minister Sharon, very statesmanlike, and a recognition. It's not new position for him. He has said it a number of times before. And if you'll recall, he's the man who actually uprooted the settlement in the Sinai that led to the full peace between Egypt and Israel. So, and the Sinai incident is a very good example of how a painful step can actually create a much better situation in the future. Certainly, Israel has no threat from its border with Egypt now, and that is an immense saving and security asset for Israel.
So at this point, how aggressive or committed, perhaps is the better word, should the United States be?
Well, I'm of the opinion that the president must take the lead in this effort. I understand and fully agree that the parties themselves have to take the responsibility for any decisions that are made, but they find it very difficult to work with each other, particularly after this long extended period of terrorism and mistrust on both sides. The United States can provide the glue. The president of the United States can provide the glue. He's been reluctant to do so because he hasn't seen a real opportunity in the past. That's understandable. But now, with the whole situation in the region in flux, with the fact that Iraq no longer poses a security threat to Israel, with that added security element, there is a new equation in the region, and one in which I believe the president can make the difference.
All right, Khalil Shikaki, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Do you see this as a different world in some ways, that where change is possible?
Well, I'm not sure that the Iraq contribution is going to make Israelis or Palestinians behave differently. I don't believe that Iraq had much of an influence in any way on Palestinian behavior or the Israeli response to that behavior.
Although they certainly were startled at how quickly the Hussein regime fell. Wasn't it something like 61% you found thought that Iraq was actually going to win the war?
Absolutely. But I don't believe that this would have any direct impact on the way that they relate to the Israelis or the way they relate to the how they should structure the relationship with Israel and the role of violence or the role of diplomacy in achieving Palestinian objectives. Palestinians expect to see end of occupation. This is their most vital need. Whether Iraq is addressed or not addressed is not going to be relevant to this question. Iraq might be relevant, however, if the American preoccupation with Iraq has deepened, and the United States does not show leadership because of that preoccupation, does not show leadership in pushing the roadmap and committing itself to its implementation. If the victory in Iraq, if you wish, is interpreted by hawks and right-wing elements in Israel and in Washington as giving them a mandate to offer the Palestinians nothing but the crumbs at the negotiating table. If that happens, certainly this is going to derail any attempts to move forward with the peace process. Presumably, the American administration said it is committed to the roadmap as it was formulated before the Iraq issue became open. As of December 20th, the quartet, including the ISIS, have agreed to a text, and that text is acceptable by the Palestinian leadership, and the majority of the Palestinians in the survey that you've mentioned did indeed say that they supported it.
Ned, did you want to get back in here?
Yeah, I did. I think Khalil is right about the Palestinians and the impact of Iraq. What I was pointing out is that it has an impact on Israel and on Israelis. I've talked to Arik Sharon many times in the past, and one of the things that he's always been concerned about is the Jordan Valley and the possibility, remote as it may seem to some people, but certainly didn't to him, that the Jordan could be destabilized, that Iraqi forces then could come over the border and could threaten Israel across the Jordan River. And if you'll remember, many of the settlements that were put in the Jordan Valley and on the hills around the Jordan Valley were there, placed there precisely because they would be military outposts to assist in the defense of the eastern border of Israel. So what I'm saying is that the strategic position of Israel has changed, and this may make it easier for Prime Minister Sharon to make some of the moves that he has in the past been reluctant to make.
All right, let's go to our phone lines and hear from some of our listeners. First to Boston, where Robert's calling in. Hi, Robert.
Hi. We just heard that the roadmap prescribes a series of interlocking trust-building measures where, you know, the Israelis pull back a little, the Palestinians control terrorism a little bit. My question is whether the guests think that the U.S. has the will to make such an approach work when we all know that there are parties on each side who don't want peace, and pretty soon into the process, someone's going to commit an act of terrorism, and, the Israelis could say, well, we're stopping because we're not going to pull out anymore because it's clear that the Palestinians don't have it under control, even though perhaps the vast majority of Palestinians would like the roadmap to succeed. Do the guests think that the U.S. has the will, despite powerful lobbies and everything, to hold both parties to the agreement to give it a fighting chance despite early attacks and things that would go against this incremental approach?
Okay, Robert, let's hear from Khalil first on that.
Well, I tend to share your reluctance to... I do not believe that the United States has shown willingness to lead in this process. I think, to a large extent, the United States has took itself out of the process for a long period of time. Fear of failure probably has been a dominant fear, and I believe that the desire to avoid a situation where the United States would find itself in confrontation with a right-wing coalition in Israel and its friends here in the United States, including the Christian right, is something that will probably deter any significant, determined leadership, the kind of leadership that would indeed be essential for any success of the implementation of the roadmap.
All right, Ned, what do you make of that? Because it does seem to be a tightrope that you must have walked when you were ambassador to Israel.
Yeah. Well, a lot depends on where the President of the United States comes out. I mean, he's the one that's going to have to make the decision, and he's the one that's going to have to take the risk. There is a slight change, or there is an actually a dynamic change that's taken place, and that is that the United States, because of the Iraq engagement, is intensely unpopular in the region. There's a great deal of anger at the United States, not because Saddam Hussein is gone, but because it has occupied an Arab country. And it has not provided security. It has not provided security for the people or for the artifacts or for the libraries and so on. So that anger has caught the attention, so to speak, of the President of the United States. And one way to try to start the process of toning that anger down, which, if if it's unchecked, can lead to more terrorism and threats against the United States, is to engage in the peace process, and it is to do something concrete and fair and just on moving the parties forward in this process. That's what gives me some hope, but I certainly agree with both the caller and Khalil that domestic politics will become increasingly important as we approach our presidential election. So it's anybody's guess whether serious progress can take place before the next election.
Robert, I want to turn back to you and pose a question that you posed in the beginning about the incremental process. If not doing this inch by inch, step by step, how would you propose that we get there?
Oh, well, I mean, if we really had the will, I think pretty much everyone knows the basic outlines of the solution. 1957 borders, minor negotiated changes to those borders. Everyone knows the outlines of where we're going. What's necessary is to basically say to both sides, okay, we're going to put peacekeepers on the ground if necessary, but we're going to say, you know, I mean, the solution that we all know we're going to have to accept pretty much at the end is what you're going to have to accept pretty much at the beginning. And so, if necessary, peacekeepers on the ground. And I'm sorry, but, you know, both sides, we have the power, if we had the will, to say to, you know, the Israeli administration, you will support this agreement despite the fact that there will be early terrorist attacks. Otherwise, you know, your funding will be temporarily frozen from, you know, the budgets and stuff. So I think it is possible, if we had to put not an imposed solution, but shall we say a firmly encouraged solution.
Okay, we got you, Robert. What about that, Khalil? Is it that simple?
I do think that a permanent status deal is, theoretically speaking, much better than the incremental approach and the partial solution of the roadmap. There is no doubt that the reason that this hasn't been adopted by the administration is the fact that Israel under Sharon is not ready for it. If what we have in Israel now is a Labor government led by someone like Barak or anybody else from Labor, the administration would indeed very much be pushing for a permanent status deal. That's what the Clinton administration did when it invited the parties to Camp David, and that's exactly what the Clinton parameters of December 2000 were all about. It's about a permanent status deal and about the belief that indeed this is the best way to put an end to the conflict and establish peace in that part of the world. And the only reason that this roadmap is structured this way is simply to provide the mechanism for Sharon to buy into it. The Palestinians are certainly ready for a permanent status deal today. There are, I believe, a great deal of issues that have already been addressed and resolved in previous negotiations. Whatever remaining issues and problems, I think, are resolvable once the parties sit down at the negotiating table. But I really do not believe for a second that a Sharon government would be a government that will take Israel to a permanent status deal. And I believe it is this recognition on the part of the administration that has deterred it from taking the same route as Clinton did.
Ned, you agree?
I agree on one half of it, but I would not say that the Palestinian people are united in their support for this agreement or any agreement with Israel. I mean, the basic tenet of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the Hamas, which do command a certain degree, a substantial degree of support among the Palestinians, is that there will not be an Israel. There'll be a unitary state. It'll be democratic in their terms, but obviously will not be Jewish because the vast majority of the people will be Arab. That's an unacceptable solution for any Israeli government, whether it's Peres or Barak or anyone else. So both sides have their problems. The Palestinians have to deal with this this problem, and the Israelis have to deal with their settler movement. I don't claim to think it's easy. I don't know whether Sharon can lead his country to this direction. I suspect that in reality we will have to face new elections in Israel before we can get a peace settlement.
Khalil, what is your polling telling you on this issue?
Well, Ned, if you've been following our polls, you can very clearly see that almost three-quarters of the Palestinians fully support a two-state solution. You're right about Islamic Jihad and Hamas. They are indeed opposed to any agreement with Israel that would recognize the legitimacy and the existence of the Jewish state, but the bulk of the majority of the Palestinians indeed do support that. The whatever disagreement there is among Israelis and Palestinians, I believe today it's not about the two-state solution, but rather about the details of what borders, how to solve the refugee issue, what to do about the holy places. I do not believe that the existential issues of the presence of the state of Israel or the Palestinian state are no longer major issues of contention.
Khalil, I want to ask you something about one of the discussions in the formation of this new cabinet. Abu Mazen had said that he wanted to dismantle the Al-Aqsa brigades and also to confront Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Now, at one time, saying that sort of thing would have been signing his own death warrant. You have to wonder what's changed so that he could even take that kind of position.
Well, Abu Mazen has always been opposed to the resort to violence in the Intifada. He, in internal meetings within Fatah, very early on during the Intifada, he has spoken out against it. He didn't find a great deal of support among other Fatah leaders then. But during the past year or so, I think we've begun to see a shift in Palestinian public opinion. I think the Palestinians are now questioning the role of violence in terms of achieving Palestinian vital objectives. And surveys that I have done during the past 6 months indicated that for the first time we have a majority of Palestinians, 70-75%, who do say today that a mutual cessation of violence is something that they would support, and that within a context of mutual cessation of violence, they would fully support a crackdown on those who would continue with the violence. It is that kind of public shift in the mood that I believe emboldens Abu Mazen to come out publicly and state his position. He knows that there is going to be indeed a lot of support from the Palestinian public for this.
Connection listeners, one critical element for Middle East peace is now in place, a new Palestinian cabinet. What do you think the United States should do next to ensure that the momentum gained today isn't lost? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about new hope for a Middle East peace. Yasser Arafat and his new Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, have at last settled on a Palestinian cabinet. The onus now, some say, is on the United States to identify the next destination on its roadmap to peace. You can join in the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us this hour from Washington is Ned Walker. He is president of the Middle East Institute. He has been the American ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. And here in our studio in Boston is Khalil Shikaki, who is director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. Khalil, I wonder if you could give us some insight into the makeup of this new cabinet, because Abu Mazen, I know, has been criticized by some Palestinians for perhaps stacking this cabinet with his old friends, his cronies, some of the same people who are perceived there to be part of the problem, not really part of the solution. How much is that a factor?
It is a very important factor. I believe that Abu Mazen isn't going to be seen, and his cabinet is not going to be seen, but the majority of the Palestinian public, as sort of a permanent type of government that Palestinians can live with. And most Palestinians will view this as a transitional government needed to get us where we are in terms of turmoil into stable conditions, but that they did not expect Abu Mazen, who comes from the old guard, who have the same mindset as Arafat, and therefore the expectation is indeed it will be a government that is staffed by cronies and friends and people who have selected because of their loyalty. That's where Abu Mazen comes from. That is his political culture, and he isn't different from Arafat in that regard. But because Palestinians believe that at this time, this is a critical time in which we want to see, most Palestinians would like to see, a transition from the old guard rule to the new guard rule. The young guards are not yet ready for it, and the old guard are about to be marginalized gradually. Abu Mazen could serve as a bridge between the two. He will not be a man who will bring in the young guards and create a modern type of government, etc., but he will be a man who will make concessions here, little concessions there, share power with this group, with that group. He isn't perfect, but as a transitional figure, I think most Palestinians will accept him.
Just quickly, why is that? Why has it been so difficult for this new generation of leaders to emerge? Is that a matter of demographics, or
hasn't been an
opening for them, really?
A large extent, it had a lot to do with the nature of the political system that has been created during the past 10 years, certainly during the past 10 years, but also the legacy of the PLO. This is a very authoritarian organization, and Arafat has been a very authoritarian leader. Under such conditions, it's extremely difficult to recruit new leaders, encourage the emergence of young leaders, give them responsibilities. Arafat had done his best to decapitate young leadership in the past, and during the past 10 years, he did not allow a lot of the young leaders to emerge. In part, that's why there is an intifada. One reason for the intifada is certainly to send a message to the Israelis about the need to end occupation, but it's also a message to Arafat and the old guard. This is time for you to go. We want to displace you with young leadership. But the young leaders are still at their early stages. They still do not have a unified leadership. They still have not yet clarified their vision for the future for the Palestinians and for themselves. So they are struggling and they're waiting.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines to Newton, Massachusetts. Hani is on the line. Hello.
Hi. How you doing, everybody? My question is that what kind of legitimacy does Abu Mazen or any other prime minister have if he needs to be okayed by Washington and Tel Aviv? I mean, if the United States and Israel holds a veto power over the prime minister of Palestine, what kind of prime minister do we have?
Annie, thank you very much for the question. It is indeed a very difficult issue for Abu Mazen to confront. It is particularly the link to Israel and the fact that Israel seems to send a signal, a positive signal about Abu Mazen. This is something that would indeed embarrass Abu Mazen. But very soon we will, as you will know, Abu Mazen will find himself in confrontation with the Israelis, as certainly Abu Mazen demands for the Israelis to freeze settlements, evacuate settlements, carry out redeployments outside of Palestinian areas, will be confronted by Israeli refusal to do so, and Abu Mazen won't have to worry about his perception at home the way that Israel is responding to him now. The difficult question is about the United States. And here, the U.S. support and embracement of Abu Mazen could become a very serious liability if the United States continues to be viewed by the Palestinians as fully supportive of the Israeli position. Remember, there was a time in 1997-99, 2 years, Arafat had a honeymoon here in Washington. He was invited to the White House so many times. President Clinton came to Gaza, was received very warmly by the Palestinians. Why? Because the United States took a very tough position vis-a-vis Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, demanding redeployment, implementation of commitments. If the United States is to show the same attitude now, that is, tough position with regard to settlements, regard redeployment, and giving the Palestinians the freedom of movement, the state with provisional borders that the roadmap is indicating, with contiguity, with real sovereign powers, if the United States is perceived by the Palestinians as pushing along these lines, then friendship between the United States and Abu Mazen is certainly not a liability. To the contrary, it's a great asset.
Ned, do you see it that way?
Yeah, I do see it that way, and I think that Khalil is actually right. I also see, however, that there is a role that Abu Mazen can play. As Khalil said, he's a transitional leader, but if he can demonstrate that he can provide greater security for the Palestinian people, that he can provide a better economy for the Palestinian people, and that he can make progress on the basic goals of the Palestinian people, that is that kind of final settlement that we all have recognized, then he will gain legitimacy as he goes along. And that's certainly what my hope is. But it does depend a lot on where the President of the United States comes out.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, honey. Let's go to Chapel Hill, North Carolina now, where we can hear from Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello. I just wanted to make the comment I teach Islam and Arab issues at a community college here in North Carolina, and I just wanted to say that I'm quite aware of the political realities in the United States regarding the Bush administration and the Jewish lobby in this country, but it seems to me that Bush could be a hero, literally a hero, to 250 million Arabs around the world and well over a billion Muslims if he simply went for a fair and just solution to the Palestinian-Israeli problem. And that would be, that would certainly involve putting major pressure on the right-wing government in Israel. And that's all I want to say.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Martin. What about that, Ned? I mean, that the question, of course, is always, what is a fair and just solution? Because that's, well, that's the hard part.
A fair and just solution is one in which the peoples on both sides buy into it and believe that they have something that they want to preserve and retain for the future. And that means that you have to have ownership on the part of both populations. You can't impose something on somebody. We tried that in Lebanon, and we had an agreement between the Israelis and the Christian government in Lebanon that lasted, I think, 2 days. Therefore, this is a process that has to engage the people on both sides and has to build the confidence between them. That's why the problem of the Hamas is still a problem.
Are you worried at all, Ned, that at some point, let's say something else awful happens and the United States just says, listen, okay, we tried and obviously we're not able to do anything here. Any chance of that, of the U.S. just walking away at some point?
Well, we've done it several times. We often think better of it after the fact, but we certainly walked away from Camp David, and there was no reason that that process could not have continued effectively on into the next administration even. It had its own momentum carried on in Taba for a while, but it was dropped, I think, prematurely by President Clinton, who had made it clear he wanted a up or down decision. I don't think the process leads to an up or down decision that quickly.
But are the stakes higher now?
Stakes are higher now because there's more people's lives being destroyed by the violence that's going on and the continued occupation of Palestinian areas. Sure, the stakes are higher, and ultimately people have to decide that it's better to make some compromises in order to live a real life and to have your children educated and to live in peace.
Khalil, I want to hear from you on this. Is this one of the things that keeps you awake at night, is that despite what seems to be some genuine progress here, that we'll be right back where we started?
Well, there is no doubt that with the roadmap or without the roadmap, conditions today are extremely difficult for Palestinians, and the pain and suffering that Palestinians go through, and certainly Israelis as well, but the amount of pain and suffering that Palestinians go through today is tremendous, and it's making them support violence and seeing no other way out of the impasse except for through violence. Although, as I said today, there's more willing to try other things, the more willing to go back to the negotiating table. The frustration in seeing settlement expansion continuing, seeing the Israelis building the wall of separation deep inside Palestinian territory, taking away to the west of the wall areas of Palestinian villages and towns. This creates tremendous level of frustration and anger among Palestinians. They see this as an indication that Israel wants to consolidate the occupation. It wants to imprison the Palestinians in their own enclaves in order to continue the domination of the control of the Palestinians. The roadmap would have to indicate very, very early on to the Palestinians that this situation is unacceptable to the Americans, to the Israelis, and this situation is going to be transformed and changed very quickly. And this has to happen in the first phase, the first 6 months of the implementation. We must see immediate steps on the freezing of the settlement construction, on the evacuation of those almost 100 outposts that have been put there in the middle of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, in order to prevent any political settlement from taking shape and Israeli withdrawal from the Palestinian areas that have been occupied since September 2000. These measures must be implemented immediately in order to bring back hope. If we don't do this, people will continue to view the whole process with a great deal of suspicion. When they see reality on the ground changing immediately in front of their own eyes, this, I believe, will transform their psychological environment, making them more willing to take risks, making them more willing to support the process.
Ned, what do you think needs to happen, particularly in the next 6 months?
Well, in the next 6 months, I agree with Khalil. There has to be a very clear change on the ground. The Israelis have to withdraw from those areas that they've occupied, areas A and B. I would hope that they would terminate this concept of building a wall. I've never seen a wall that worked. I visited the Bar-Lev line before the 1973 war. I thought it was impregnable. Well, it certainly wasn't. It's a false sense of security that something like a wall gives you, and particularly if it only angers people more and gives them more incentive to break into violence. So I think that there are steps that can be taken initially to start the process. I think they need to be followed up with a very strong position on those illegal settlements, which even the government of Israel calls illegal. They have to be eliminated, and then there has to be a freeze in further construction and new outposts of settlements. And this has to happen very quickly.
Khalil, we only have a couple of minutes, but I want to point out that there were some encouraging numbers from your poll that a majority of both Palestinians and Israelis said that they support reconciliation after a peace agreement is reached.
Yes, indeed. This is probably the most dramatic result of Oslo. Despite all the failings of the Oslo process, what it did to the psychological environment of Israelis and Palestinians is this: the recognition that there is absolutely no way that one can dominate the other side, or that the one can deny the national aspirations of the other side, that they need to share this land. The decision on the part of both publics to accept this notion of a two-state solution and to accept and support reconciliation based on a two-state solution is, in my view, the most pronounced achievement of the Oslo process. It is fantastic that that it had taken us that far, despite all the failures and the violence. This is still the case today.
We thank you so much. First to Khalil Shikaki, who is the director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah. So glad you could be with us, Khalil.
Thank you.
And to Ambassador Edward Walker. He is president of the Middle East Institute. Thanks so much, Ned.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Ambassador Walker was the U.S. ambassador to Israel from 1997 to 99. And earlier today on the program, we also heard from James Bennett, the Middle East correspondent for the New York Times. Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation online at theconnection.org. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.